primary voting in the U.S. presidential election gets underway.
So this is going to be a fun ride, and I don't think it's going to be as a smooth one as Donald Trump anticipates.
The world will have its first trillionaire by the end of the decade.
The world's richest five men, and they all are men, I should add, have more than double their fortunes this decade since 2020. And that's at the top. While 5 billion people, nearly 5 billion people, have been made poorer.
And a new restaurant is opening in California, where robots take your order and make your food.
Robots that can remember faces will take customer orders and handle payments.
Today is Tuesday, January 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. As frigid temperatures hit the Midwest part of the United States, the U.S. presidential nominating process officially started Monday with Iowa's caucuses. Republicans held their caucuses in person, with the four candidates left in the race making their final pitches. Donald Trump.
You got to get out. You can't sit home. If you're sick as a dog, you say, darling, I got to make it. Even if you vote and then pass away, it's worth it, remember?
Nikki Haley.
We can't deal with the chaos anymore. This is not what Americans want to be talking about. They're wanting to know why economy's high, and why inflation's high, why everything's more expensive. They want to know why we aren't focused on getting our kids reading again. They want to know how we're allowing the lawlessness at the border that's out of control. That's what they want to talk about, not whether somebody's MAGA or not.
Ron DeSantis.
You can be the most worthless Republican in America, but if you kiss the ring, he'll say, you're wonderful. You can be the strongest, most dynamic, successful Republican and conservative in America, but if you don't kiss that ring, then he'll try to trash you. You know what? You deserve a nominee that's going to put you first, not himself first.
Vivek Ramaswamy.
I respect Donald Trump. He got this fight started, but now it's our job to finish it.
Democrats in Iowa are also holding their caucuses, but they are voting by mail. As results started being reported, the networks that do exit polling called the race for former President Trump in the Republican caucus. At the time of our deadline, the final tally was not known. Joining us now is political consultant Matt Klink. Matt has more than 30 years of experience working on campaigns for elected office and ballot measures. Given the Trump win, which everyone expected, what are we looking for, data-wise, from the Iowa contest?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a question, though, of how much he finishes in first. If Donald Trump gets over 50% of the vote, that sends a very powerful statement. However, if he gets under 50%, both Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley can legitimately say that half of all caucus goers preferred someone else. And that just sends a less than dominating message for Donald Trump.
Oh, that's interesting.
Don't forget that Donald Trump was out there bragging that he had a 60-point lead over his competition. And over time, as we've gotten closer to the caucuses, that number has slowly eroded. And if he's below 50%, I think it gives Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis momentum heading into New Hampshire, which will be a real vote, not a caucus. And I think that will be more telling of where the state of the Republican race really is.
Do you think that erosion is because he started talking again and started getting coverage again, and people remember now the fatigue of listening to his rhetoric? Or do you think it's the court cases, or is it a little bit of both?
I think it's all of the above, and I think that as is typical in Iowa, people are willing to give candidates a second or even a third chance, and you see the candidates in person, you can kick the tires, metaphorically speaking, and you can see who makes a good candidate and who doesn't.
I was reading a story. So there's two different voters, you know, insofar as Trump goes. Here's a 49-year-old from Council Bluffs, Iowa, who says, quote, I absolutely love a lot of the things Trump did, but his personality is just a just kind of getting in his way. And here's a second, a 71-year-old retired woman, and here's her quote. Trump is a Christian, he's trustworthy, he believes in America, and he believes in freedom. So, you know, is that where the party stands now?
I think that that's a pretty good description. Look, it is undeniable that the world was a safer place when Donald Trump was president. There was no Israeli invasion of Israeli invaded by Hamas. Don't forget that Russians have attacked Ukraine under two Democrat presidents, not under Donald Trump. The economy, leaving COVID aside, was largely beyond Donald Trump's control. The economy was much stronger. Everything was more affordable. Interest rates were low. And Joe Biden's presidency has not been a recipe of strength. It's been one of weakness and frustration. And their message is, oh, you're just not hearing us. Things are really a lot better. The American people aren't stupid. And then there's the other part of the Republican caucus or the Republican voter that strongly believes that Donald Trump speaks for them, that he's speaking for the forgotten, that, you know, he does embrace Christianity, which is interesting given that given all of Donald Trump's peccadillos. Yet he still feels like he's looking out for them and that the Washington, D.C. establishment is targeting Trump because he's not from them. And I think those are the two sides of the Republican caucus that need to reconcile ultimately to defeat Joe Biden, which needs to be the top message, irrespective of who the Republican nominee is. But again, you know, there's a reason that we have the elections. If this thing were over just because people said it was over, we would have had Biden versus Trump in the general election and forget all the caucuses and the primaries. So this is going to be a fun ride, and I don't think it's going to be as a smooth one as Donald Trump anticipates.
Political consultant Matt Klink. Since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, observers say Moscow has significantly stepped up the spread of fake news about Ukraine. Kasina Turkova looks at what topics Russia has focused on and some of its most outlandish claims. Anna Rice narrates this story.
This is some of the fake news that observers say Russia has published about Ukraine. Kyiv is sending kids to fight. Ukraine has made bulletproof vests for pregnant women. Ukrainian refugees give birth to kids in Swiss bunkers and then sell them. Concentration camp was established near Odessa for those who don't want to fight against Russia. These are actual headlines from Russian media outlets, according to a Ukrainian fact-checking website called Stop Fake. Co-founder Yevhen Fetchenko says even the most outlandish fake news should be debunked even as false information pours in.
Their main goal is to publish as many fakes as possible and bomb their audience with these fakes from all platforms, not giving it a chance to take a breath and see what's actually happening. The goal is to saturate the media landscape with fakes.
In 2023, Fetchenko says Russia's fake news centered on the front lines and Western aid to Ukraine.
Some were made to undermine the West's trust in Ukraine. This was the largest category. It's clear that it aligns with Russia's political and military goals to undermine any trust in Ukraine and to stop providing it with any sort of aid.
Fetchenko says Moscow has also pumped out countless articles falsely claiming that the West is sending Ukraine broken machinery, that Ukrainians do not know how to use it, and that Russia is managing to destroy it successfully.
We've seen headlines about Russia destroying the first F-16, even though previously Russia published pieces saying Ukrainians didn't know how to fly the F-16s. And even if they did, it would change nothing. And then, boom, news about how Russia has destroyed them, even before they made it to Ukraine.
Russia used AI to help produce its fake news last year. Fetchenko cites two deepfake videos spread by Russia One that attempts to depict the head of Ukraine's armed forces allegedly calling for a coup, and another showing a conversation between President Zelensky and his wife. None of this was true.
This deepfake showed us that AI was able to analyze and recreate Zelensky's speech pretty well, but failed to do so with Zelensky's wife, because she didn't make as many speeches. So as a result, we see Zelensky speak Russian for some reason, and his wife responding to him in a weird Ukrainian dialect. None of this worked, of course.
Fedchenko says he and his team are doing all they can to counter Russia's flood of propaganda, but it's impossible to catch it all. Ksenia Turkova, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. North Korea is formally abolishing a handful of key government agencies charged with promoting cooperation and reunification with the South. State media reported on Tuesday that the decision was announced by the North's rubber stamp parliament. It comes just weeks after Kim Jong-un said that continuing to seek reconciliation with the South was a mistake. Foreign, interior, and defense ministers of Andean countries will hold an urgent meeting this weekend to discuss the problem of cross-border drug crime that has plunged Ecuador into a major security crisis. Peruvian Prime Minister Alberto Otaola told reporters the meeting in Lima on Sunday will focus on ways to confront transnational crime. Houthi rebels fired a missile striking a U.S.-owned ship Monday just off the coast of Yemen in the Gulf of Aden. Less than a day after they launched an anti-ship cruise missile toward an American destroyer in the Red Sea. The attack on the Gibraltar Eagle, later claimed by Houthis, further escalates tensions gripping the Red Sea after American-led strikes on the rebels. In Israel, there has been talk about dissatisfaction with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu since the surprise attack by Hamas in October. Now, Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino has this story about new polling data showing that only about 15% of Israelis say they want Netanyahu to remain in office after the war on Hamas ends.
Israelis are still reeling months after the October 7th attack by Hamas militants, but stunned by the massive security failure, many say it's time for the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to go.
Netanyahu has been prime minister for many years, and I think now it's time for him to step up and go home, because this, what happened on the 7th of October, is a big crisis, and he should take responsibility.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I think he's done. He's finished. But never mind, I will still vote for the right.
Netanyahu had for years brandished himself with a Mr. Security image. But only 15% of Israelis say they want him to remain in office after the war on Hamas ends. That's according to a poll published by the nonpartisan Israel Democracy Institute on January 2nd. The anti-government protests that swept over Israel for almost a year have rekindled after a pause. But the embattled Netanyahu is showing no signs of wanting to leave.
And now, if he really lost a lot of support, so I think that's it. He cannot continue.
Political science chair Gideon Rahat at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem said Netanyahu will have a difficult time reclaiming his image.
No peace initiatives. No big wars. That was his policy. He sustained it, and many people were happy about it because he gave you a feeling of security, of peace, of prosperity. And then it all went wrong on October 7th.
But while political change looks unlikely in the near term, there are signs that some are jockeying for position. Reports of wrangling within the security cabinet have been leaked to the Israeli press. And far-right police minister Itamar Ben-Gavir has taken swipes at Benny Gantz, Israel's former centrist defense chief who joined Netanyahu's emergency government and war cabinet. Gantz has seen his popularity soar in the polls, with voters eyeing him as a responsible man of the people.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino, Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. Today's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. There's an old saying that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. In recent years, the gap between the haves and the have-nots is growing at what some people say is an alarming rate. Now, Henry Ridgwell reports an international charity is warning of a big increase in global inequity. It says the world is now on course to see its first trillionaire by the end of the decade.
The Blue Origin rocket company is just one of the ventures owned by Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon and one of the top three richest men in the world, according to Forbes. The charity Oxfam says Bezos's wealth and that of other multi-billionaires has increased sharply, while much of the world is getting poorer. Nabil Ahmed is a co-author of the Oxfam report.
The world's richest five men, and they all are men, I should add, have more than doubled their fortunes this decade since 2020. And that's at the top. While 5 billion people, nearly 5 billion people, have been made poorer, at current rates, the world will see its first trillionaire within a decade, while it'll take over two centuries to end poverty.
Oxfam says the global economy has entered a new era,
in which corporates are funneling immense wealth, but also control over our economies into the hands of an ultra-rich few.
Bezos and other multi-billionaires say their companies generate taxes and jobs. The Oxfam report was published as world leaders and top executives arrived in the Swiss ski resort of Davos Monday for the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. The Davos meeting will address high global debt and interest rates, along with new economic challenges and opportunities, especially artificial intelligence, or AI. Aidan Gomez is chief executive of Cohere, a Canadian artificial intelligence company.
I think it's important to think about the opportunities for good. And it's not spoken about enough, but I think you're going to see some pretty incredible things coming as an output from AI, and I hope people don't discount that or forget it.
Critics argue the Davos summit is an undemocratic get-together for the global elite. Its supporters say that in an increasingly fractious and uncertain world, dialogue like that taking place at Davos is vital. Henry Ridgwell, VOA News, London.
And finally, one of the things impacting working people is the coming of the robot age. For example, if you walk into a modern car factory, you'll see robots assembling automobiles where union workers once stood. Now, in the U.S. state of California this month, a new restaurant is opening. It's called Cali Express. At this restaurant, robots will make the food in the kitchen, and AI will take your orders. There'll only be one human worker whose job it is to physically give you your food. Angelina Bagdasarian reports, narrated by Anna Rice.
While one robot is making fries, another one is making hamburgers after prepping them.
In the back, there's a refrigerator that has chunks of meat, so it fresh grinds every single patty and forms it to order.
The first fully automated restaurant in the world is opening in Pasadena. Robots that can remember faces will take customer orders and handle payments. What's more, owners say it's a revolutionary breakthrough in safety, as slippage and burns can be nearly eliminated, and waste reduced in both food and oil.
We're really focused on the restaurant space. If you think about the restaurant space, it's, you know, they don't have the best technology. It's not really the same as the tech industry. It's the area really that technology left behind.
Restaurant management says the robots are perfect workers. No special requests, no raised demands. And although the amount in maintenance costs is not fully known yet, the owners don't anticipate these to be significant.
We're talking about 5 to 6 people per shift, down to one. So that's, what, an 80% savings?
Saving money is the big driver behind the push to introduce robots to the workforce. In 2023, California Governor Gavin Newsom raised the minimum wage for fast food restaurant workers to $20 an hour. a wage you don't have to pay robots.
One argument on the part of employers who were against the proposition to elevate the minimum wage for frontline workers was that that was going to make it more expensive for them to operate, and they were going to look for ways to cut costs.
Gaspar Rivera Saldago is with the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Rivera Saldago says raising the minimum wage was an attempt to get workers into the fast food business. Lomelino acknowledges that robots are a way to avoid paying that higher wage, but says the robots are doing jobs many people don't want.
But the truth of the matter is, even paying $20 an hour in Pasadena, I will have a hard time hiring enough staff to work here in this restaurant.
While customers might enjoy the novelty of being served by a robot, Saldago says there are tech issues and that, more importantly, people like talking to people.
The employees complain that, you know, they have to monitor these automatic machines because they tend to fail a lot. People end up wanting to talk to a human being because they know that human beings can process more complex requests.
Robots already play huge roles in the manufacturing industry, and inevitably, robotics will infiltrate more and more industries over time. But it remains to be seen if the world is ready for a robot to wait on them and a robotic chef. For Angelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is making global health security a national security priority in 2024. We're going to elevate global health security as part of our foreign policy and diplomacy, said Dr. John Nkengasong, Ambassador-at-Large, U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, and Senior Bureau Official for Global Health Security and Diplomacy, or GHSD, in an exclusive interview. The recent creation of the new State Department Bureau is one of several acts the Biden administration has taken to prepare to handle emerging health threats. The outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic showed that in an interconnected world, threats to public health have global consequences. COVID-19 impacted trade, impacted housing, impacted economies and development in a way that we couldn't even imagine, said Dr. Nkengasong.
That tells you how close we are, the connectivity that we have with each other, the vulnerability that we have with each other in the world.
To prepare for new threats that could spread globally in a matter of weeks, the United States will help its partners by supporting the development, enhancement, and maintenance of effective global health security capacities through sustained political, financial, and technical support, according to a statement from the GHSD. There are at least 50 countries that the United States is supporting to better prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease threats. The United States must maintain focus and develop platforms in these partner countries, said Dr. Nkengasong.
We're going to coordinate as much as possible and make sure that we lead by what I call the four C's. We cooperate, we collaborate, we coordinate, and we communicate with our partner countries.
Another significant U.S. contribution to global health security is the Pandemic Fund, said Dr. Nkengasong. The fund is a partnership of donor countries and co-investors hosted by the World Bank that is focused solely on supporting pandemic prevention and response. The United States is currently the largest contributor to the Pandemic Fund and is actively working with partners to secure additional funding. In the new year, the United States will continue to work to learn lessons from past pandemics and work with partner countries to develop global health capacity, said Dr. Nkengasong. A threat from anywhere in the world is a threat everywhere in the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.